This episode of Keeping Up with Public Health was recorded June 25th, 2019. The opinions and views discussed may have changed and may not reflect current medical research.
What I would say to the young public health professionals, you're building your brand from day one. What do you want to be seen as? Do you want to be seen as a problem solver, or do you want to be branded as a lightning rod? That no matter where you go, you're accusing people and screaming and yelling and protesting.
Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Richard Carmona. Dr. Carmona was the 17th Surgeon General of the United States and is the Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health. He also holds faculty appointments as a Professor of Surgery and Pharmacy. Trained in general and vascular surgery, Dr. Carmona also has completed a National Institute of Health-sponsored fellowship in trauma, burns, and critical care. In 2002, Dr. Carmona was nominated by the President and unanimously confirmed by the United States Senate to become the 17th Surgeon General. Dr. Carmona was selected because of his extensive experience in public health, clinical sciences, healthcare management, preparedness, and his commitment to prevention as an effective means to improve public health and reduce healthcare costs while improving the quality and quantity of life. As Surgeon General, Dr. Carmona focused on prevention, preparedness, health disparities, health literacy, and global health to include health diplomacy. He also issued many landmark Surgeon General communications during his tenure, including the definitive Surgeon General's report about the dangers of secondhand smoke. I'm also sitting here today with Emily Moss. Emily Moss is a Tucson native and Master of Public Health specializing in public health policy and management. While completing her MPH, she evaluated health risks in the student population and facilitated a peer educational program that trained undergraduates as health educators who can use their skills to catalyze grassroots changes in their community. Emily completed her internship through the National Academy of Social Insurance in Washington, D.C. As a summer's aging and long-term care intern, Emily conducted research at Community Catalyst on value-based payment structures in Medicaid and methods to utilize them to fund public health programs aimed at addressing the social determinants of health. In October, Emily will be part of the Public Health Associate Program, a two-year fellowship with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention Center for State, Tribal, Local, and Territorial Support. She will work with the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians Public Health and Human Services Division on accreditation. Thank you so much for being here today. We're sitting here today with Dr. Richard Carmona, the 17th Surgeon General of the United States. You want to talk a little bit more about who you are, your journey, where you come from?
Sure, Santa. I'm happy to, because my life's journey actually really prepared me for what I ended up doing later in life and made me more sensitized to health disparities, the social determinants of health, and a lot of the challenges we all face as public health professionals, dealing with those in a very complex, sometimes dysfunctional, hyper-politicized environment where it's tough to get things done. So my parents were immigrants and spoke Spanish as their first language. English was my first language, and I did that transition. I have two brothers and a sister. We grew up relatively poor, but we were happy. Grew up in Harlem in New York City and ran the streets. And my two brothers, my sister and I, none of us finished high school. And with not a job and little skills, I joined the Army at 17 years old. Got an equivalency diploma, went in the Army. Of course, this was when the Vietnam War was peaking, and even if you failed the test, they were going to take you because they needed bodies. And then I, you know, really learned more about life than I did about soldiering. It taught me how duty and honor and country, respect, how to complete a mission, you know, all of these things. And I got my equivalency diploma in the Army and went on from being an infantryman, a fighter, to jump school, to special forces, and a special forces medical, and a weapons specialist. And that really changed my whole life. And so that's the foundations for my understanding of health, especially global health, as a young soldier, traveling the world and seeing these problems firsthand. And recognizing that even though I grew up in what people would call the ghetto or the poor areas, I lived in relative luxury compared to what I saw in the rest of the world.
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah, we are. Thank you for your service, first of all. So that's quite the journey to get to Surgeon General. And I know when you were Surgeon General, you've done a lot of work with tobacco. Mm-hmm. And that's why I love having you come to my class to give a guest lecture in Drugs and Society, because a lot of the kids, especially due to your work, see tobacco as a problem that isn't as important anymore. That's kind of gone away. Smoking isn't as cool anymore. But how did we get to that point? And what did you do as Surgeon General to get us to that really great point?
Well, I'm glad you brought up smoking, because my first introduction to tobacco was my parents, who smoked, and both died at an early age, as it relate earlier They lived into their 70s, but everybody else in their family lived to 100, you know, or close to it. So a lot of the illnesses they had later in life was from tobacco. And I had chronic pulmonary problems. They realized, not realizing that their smoke was making the kids have bronchitis and asthma and all of those things. And so that's my first experiences. And then, of course, as I advanced and ultimately became Surgeon General, working as a paramedic, working as a nurse, registered nurse, physician's assistant, a teacher, all of those jobs, you know, gave me a different eye view of society. And then ultimately being Surgeon General is unique because you're sitting at the table as history is being made, as policy is being made, and you get to contribute to policy as well. And one of the things I'm most proud of the many things that me or my team and I did as Surgeon General, was the Surgeon General's report on secondhand smoke, which really went viral, and we're very proud of that. And because of that, not only was the United States affected with a whole host of state-derived and national legislation, but most of the modern countries in the world adopted what we did. And so now you have smoke-free areas in every place, and it's not cool to smoke anymore, and so on. So it had an impact globally. And when you look at it epidemiologically, pretty extraordinary about all the lives we'll save, the reduction in cost of healthcare is extraordinary.
Yeah, no, it's extraordinary to hear that 18-year-old kids in my class live in a time where, you know, there were areas where you could smoke in a plane or a restaurant, and it's just such it's unfathomable to them.
Yeah, it is. It's super interesting to see that transition. One of the things I think is really interesting is that overall Surgeon Generals tend to be really proactive, and you guys often are really disruptive, and you bring up these awesome ideas about, like, we need to change these pieces, and then you get a ton of pushback from the money, power, politics, yes, and some of the cultural changes that sometimes Surgeon Generals try to make. So can you speak to that a little bit? How did you navigate that, mm-hmm, and what advice do you have to us?
Well, it is probably a combat zone of its own. Okay, let me put it that way. And the reason being that as a Surgeon General, you're not a Republican or a Democratic Surgeon, mm-hmm, General. You're the doctor of the nation. And just as you're a physician and you see your patients, you don't only see people of one party. Okay, Democrats and Republicans get sick. Atheists and Jews and Christians get sick. Yeah. You take care of everybody. Yeah. Okay, that's what America is about. And so the challenge, of course, is each party, or now tribe, as we, you know, yeah, takes their own positions that are politically driven, that are funded by special interest groups, and of course, trying to listen to their communities as well that represent the diversity of this nation. But yet the Surgeon General looks at 300 million people and goes, what's the best policy I can do to vaccinate children, to make sure that everybody has access to good food, clean water, and so on? And sometimes those run up against challenges in the political world. And so what happens is the Surgeon General tends to have to be careful because each party tries to pull you left or right.
Yes.
Because nothing would give them the credibility they desire more than the Surgeon General say, well, the Democrats really got this right, or the Republicans, mm-hmm, got it left or right.
Right.
I shouldn't say left or right because that denotes political.
but
correct.
Better, right?
I should say the word is correct.
Yes.
Okay. That got it correct. So and often the press would bait you. They'd say, So Surgeon General, what did you think about the Democrats' proposal about this? And the answer is always, let me tell you about the science behind this particular issue. Okay? But did you agree with the Democrats or Republicans? I said, I'd agree that what I said to you is what the people need. The politicians get to decide. I will filter it through the scientific lens and tell you the best practices available, the best science available. If we don't have it, what studies we need to get it, that's my job. Okay? I stay out of the partisanship. Because as soon as you become partisan, the other side of the aisle is going to ignore you and doesn't want to do with you. So you're really walking a tightrope for those four years.
Yeah.
And each side trying to pull you left or right. And I found out after the first year, when they saw that you were legitimately honest and that you weren't trying to embarrass either side, that then they left you alone. And they went, and I, you know, I worked for a Republican administration. My best friend was Teddy Kennedy. I met with him all the time. We worked together.
Yeah.
Okay. And I had Republican guys on me, but they trusted me because they knew that I was practicing my position with integrity and I wasn't there politically.
Yes.
I was there to provide. And that's the challenge because the position has now been disempowered, marginalized. You don't hear from the Surgeon General anymore.
No.
And that's the politicians who have marginalized it because, in my opinion, they're fearful of somebody speaking truth to power and science to truth to power.
So our audience is public health professionals. And
you go, guys.
Yes. And oftentimes the job of the public health professional is to take those facts and frame them in a way that is accessible to the general public.
Yes.
And to put the facts out there. But oftentimes we do see that certain political parties or factions can politicize those facts. So what is your strategy, recommendation, tips on how to communicate effectively in a persuasive manner without allowing those facts to become politicized?
First and foremost, just a little funny act. I used to have when I was at Surgeon General, I'm back in Washington, and I've had some of the faculty here would call me or from my previous institution, UCSF and others, and they'd be frustrated. Go, come on, what is this thing here? This is all political. You know, why are you doing? I said, you have some misunderstanding. Everything in Washington is political, okay? Everything. There's nothing. I mean, whether you're talking about vaccines, maternal child mortality, food programs, food stamps, it's all political. So you have to navigate that minefield of politics with the thought in mind is what's best for the people. Mm-hmm. And to your question, Sana, I think that you have to become a health diplomat to be able to be successful. You have to be able to sit with the R's and the D's and listen to both sides. And in private, call them out on some of the stuff, on things like global warming, okay? Or, you know, food policy, you know, things like that. I mean, I was at a meeting once where I had pointed out to some of the legislators that we have about 150,000 birth defects. This is going back over a decade, about 150,000 birth defects every year. And in discussions with my team from CDC, FDA, NIH, we determined that probably you could prevent 120,000 birth defects every year if every woman of pregnancy age got a multivitamin,
yes,
folic acid, a good diet during the gestational period, and had prenatal care.
Yeah, that led to the cereal fortification.
Yeah. But I mean, it's like, okay, this is pretty simple stuff. It's not rocket science.
Yeah.
But yet some people said to me, so you really want another welfare program is what you're telling me. Mm-hmm. I said, no, you don't understand. What I'm saying is we can prevent thousands of these disabilities, and ultimately, if we don't, we will pay for this anyway, because no mom or dad is going to be able to pay for a child with a spinal condition or a defect that now is going to go on for 20, 30, maybe a lifetime, and we pay. So we can look at it through a business lens and say, let's do this because we want to save the money, or we can look at it as a humanity thing with a heart and say, I don't want the kids to suffer that. Okay.
Right.
So I give each side an option.
Definitely.
But what I need is both of you to come together and help me with this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think finding the common ground is what the good surgeon generals really do, because you understand the science, but you also understand the political discourse, which is often hyperpartisan and, you know, name calling and flame throwing and all of that. But trying to be a health diplomat and say, okay, I understand what you're saying. I understand your constituents. But here's the issue as it relates to health policy.
Yeah.
And sometimes you win and sometimes you lose.
Yeah.
But I think what we all had in common, of all of my predecessors that I knew, and one of my mentors was Surgeon General Coop, Chick Coop, who lived to almost 100 years old. And one of the first things he told me when I came to Washington and we met, he said, Richard, and Surgeon General Coop and I were the only two surgeons, real surgeons in history that had been surgeon generals. All the other docs had been primary care. So we had a unique distinction. He was the father of pediatric surgery in the United States and probably one of the most effective surgeon generals in history. But he said to me, Richard, you have to be careful in your position because people are going to come to you every day and say, you need to do this because the White House wants it done.
Right.
And he said, I learned pretty quickly I had to ask them, who in the White House wants to have it done? And he said to me jokingly, he said sometimes he would say, well, was it a window that spoke to you? Was it a door? And he said, so be careful because they will want to co-opt your credibility for their political purposes. And if that happens, you will be discredited.
Yeah.
Very good, very good advice. And at a local level, I would say to the both of you, it's the same issue with a local health professional speaking to a mayor or a city council member or to a governor. You know, how do you tell your story that makes sense for what they need accomplished in whatever their lens is that they're looking at? And that's the tough part. And you realize sometimes you can't win, but it's worth the battle because you can advance at least the issue forward. And maybe your successor gets to bring it to the finish line.
And that, like, we're really curious about some of your advice for advocates, because since you've left the office, you've done a lot of maybe you don't like to use the term advocate, but I see you as an advocate for public health and for just really calling truth to some of the issues in the system we have. You've been very vocal about the role of lobbyists since leaving. So like, what advice do you have to advocates when we come up against lobbyists?
Well, I think that what I would say to the young public health professionals, you're building your brand from day one. What do you want to be seen as? Do you want to be seen as a problem solver, or do you want to be branded as a lightning rod? Mm-hmm. That no matter where you go, you're accusing people and screaming and yelling and protesting. I tended to take more the diplomatic approach. When I have to stand firm, I'll stand firm. But I think if people just see you as somebody who's always throwing flames back at somebody and accusations and, you know, those kind, well, that doesn't really work. So I would say consider everything you do in the context of, as a young public health professional, everything you do is building a brand, and ultimately your colleagues will come to know you by your actions. Mm-hmm. And if they see you as a person that's committed, that you're scientifically knowledgeable, that you're willing to take on the tough problems, and that when you speak with the voice of reason and scientific determination, okay, but also recognizing that we in public health rarely get to make the policy, but we inform on the policy. So you can't get frustrated and blow the place up and scream and yell at people yeah. because you didn't get your way. You got to live to come back another day. Sure. And it's frustrating and it's painful, especially when we see that it affects the morbidity or mortality of populations. But all of us have to continue. And even though you may lose a battle today, you may win the next time. Your successor may have an easier path once they come in because you've kind of cleared the field, you know. And as as parties change left and right and right and left, sometimes that opens doors for you as well. And that's probably another interesting point. You cannot be an effective public health professional unless you understand the political structure in the environment you work. Mm-hmm. So if you're in Pima County, you need to know about a board of supervisors and a city council, the mayor, you know, and you need to know all those interfaces. You need to know about the emergency medical system. You need to know about vaccinations. You need to know about the clinics that are taking care of the poor. You need to know about immigration issues because we're on the border, okay? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that, because now if you're in Nebraska, it's a different, maybe a different issue, okay? But the concept of understanding the environment you're in is extremely important. And in my opinion, we don't spend enough time in our undergraduate and graduate programs on the politics of public health.
Definitely.
Understanding how to become an effective executor, advocate, whatever you want to call it, somebody who does stuff for good.
Yeah.
And then when you get to the national level, okay, it's even bigger because once I'm there, I'm dealing with the UN, I'm dealing with World Health Organization, Pan American Health Organization. I travel to dozens and dozens of countries representing our nation, okay? So I need to know, what's the politics in this country? How do they work? Who makes the decisions on healthcare?
Yeah.
If you show up and you're ill-informed, you miss the opportunity to really do something positive, or at least inform on something positive.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And I think you're one of the most, one of the people in the country that's like an advocating, we were just going back to the tobacco issue.
Sure.
I need to cut this all out. But going back to the tobacco issue, I mean, all of your work in D.C. really helped reducing the rates, but then something new popped up, vaping popped up, and the e-cigarette popped up.
Yeah.
And in this country, I mean, I think you can talk about it a little bit better, but the harm reduction aspect of it, I know that you've have said that vaping can be a tool for harm reduction. Other countries, Europe, mostly
UK,
use it as a harm reduction tool, but we're very hesitant to do that in the United States.
Yes.
And that was something when you came and spoke to my class, the students had no idea that vaping could be used as a harm reduction tool. It didn't even cross their minds.
And remember when I asked, many of the students didn't know that there was no tobacco in e-cigarettes.
That was horrifying. That was a horrifying moment. So
I said, no, you know, it's basically, it's a nicotine delivery device, okay? So, but the point, to your point, and I think those are good discussions we had in your class, that I opened the students' eyes, because as you know, first when I start with the students, the first thing I tell them, you don't have to take any notes. You may not be tested on this. But when you leave, I want you to think about things in a different way. I want you to think, because that's what's going to separate you apart from everybody else. If you're always going to fire your shot based on your own bias, you're not really a public health practitioner. You need to think about it and say, what am I doing here? What's the greater good? What is the issue? So I often, as Sana knows in the class, I will challenge the kids. You know, and I'll let them take a side, and then I'll take the other side. Okay, so defend yourself. You know, well, my friends do it. You know, well, that's not good. But I think this is a contentious issue in our country, and it's because each side in the public health community has dug in and said, okay, it looks like a cigarette, it has vapor, and it has nicotine, and it's just going to addict the children. Yes, if children get it, they will. So when I've worked with e-cigarette companies, I said, I'll give you advice, but you have to do the following. And the first company I did, I said, you have to come with me, and I'm going to introduce you to the FDA, and you have to ask for regulation. And the regulation has to include ban against children. Children cannot have access to this, okay? And I went through a whole other list of things. You can't sell to a tobacco company. If you do, I'll never be your advisor. I'm going to call you out in public, okay? Mm-hmm. But I will give you advice as to the approach for harm reduction. And if you follow that advice, I'll continue to give you advice, okay? But if I see that you're doing these things that are going to be counterproductive, I won't do it. Now, in the UK, they actually fund these e-cigarettes because in their literature, they have found that there is harm reduction. And they have found that it is not a gateway, okay? Mm-hmm. Some of our literature contradicts that, and you can argue the bias in it or not, right. You know? But the point is, I'm still a firm believer that if used correctly, it has the potential for harm reduction, mm-hmm. okay, if used correctly. And I'm a strong advocate of FDA not only regulating it, but regulating production, because some of the problems we had, so many people were producing, there were contaminants in it. Yeah. There was metals. Yep. There was all kinds of bad stuff.
Yep.
So if it's a pure product, manufacturing standards are met, public health standards are met, and it's only for harm reduction used in populations who smoke, what's different than putting a nicotine patch on or chewing Nicorette gum?
Sure.
Okay. So that was where I came in on that. It's tough. And some of my colleagues, you know, were pretty hostile toward me when I said that.
Definitely.
But I thought it was a pretty moderate, scientifically based approach. And as more information comes in, I may move further one side or the other. But the science will drive me.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a really great approach. And I think one of the things that I think we're struggling with the way that vaping kind of came on the scene, or at least that I see, because I was in a health educator role with college students the last 2 years as I got my MPH. And one of the things that's really interesting is because juuling and vaping have been sold as this harm reduction thing, young kids have this perception of, well, it's totally safe. There's absolutely no harm to this. There's no nicotine in this. This isn't the same. And so I think, what advice do you have for us as a public health community as far as balancing the message of, this is, at least as far as we currently know, safer than cigarettes and can help reduce the harm of people who are currently addicted to cigarettes. However, please still don't start smoking these. Please still aren't using these, because it's a really hard argument to navigate. And I think people wind up getting sucked into whatever they want. And then if you add the addicted components of nicotine, that makes it
And like you said, digging
worse.
Into their positions even further.
So I think the issue here is right frame it in health literacy, okay? That we have to figure out a way to communicate to the average person some very complex issues that are causing discussion among our professionals. And so the fact that when I talk to the class, I often say, look, tell me how it's different than putting on a nicotine patch or gum.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting my nicotine fix. So if I get my hit of nicotine and it doesn't have carcinogens in it, isn't that better than a tobacco with carcinogens, okay? And pulmonary disease and everything else that goes along, cancers. So that's the premise. But to your point, when most people think e-cigarettes have tobacco and they think they can cause cancer, I mean, everything is convoluted.
Yeah.
And then you have some of my colleagues who just feel it's not worth the risk because it looks like a cigarette. And how do we regulate that? You see smoke coming out. Do I run up to everybody and say, is that an e-cigarette or is that a real cigarette when you're on campus? Are we going to have campus tobacco police, okay, that go to check, all right? So in what the policies that have been promulgated are ones that say, you can't smoke anything, okay? Because I don't have the resources to be able to check that's an e-cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, I get questions now, well, what about secondhand smoke with e-cigarettes, okay?
Yeah.
And obviously, that hasn't been adequately studied. But at least there's no carcinogens or combustibles that can cause disease. But you have to say, well, if I'm living with a person that's smoking e-cigarettes, am I getting the nicotine and will I get addicted as well? Those are reasonable questions that need to be answered, okay? But we as professionals have to do a better job of taking complex science, translating it in a health literate, culturally competent manner to give to an end user to effect sustainable behavioral change. And everything we do in public health, that's the equation.
That is the exact equation. I think you just summed up our whole 2-year MPH program in one sentence. I think that really just encompassed the whole program there.
Yeah, you could have saved me so much time.
That would have worked out.
Well, and as you guys know, I'm just a recovering surgeon. So, I mean, I did the clinical side for years. And as you know, the reason I moved over to a second career was most everything I was taking care of was preventable.
Yeah.
The gunshot wounds, the stab wounds, the domestic violence, drunk drivers, no helmet, no seatbelt. And you make a very good living taking care of society's indiscretions. Mm-hmm. But it starts to weigh on you for a while that maybe we should be befriending these things rather mm-hmm. than waiting and caring for them.
Yeah. So another thing we wanted to touch base with you on is tobacco 21 laws, because those are becoming more and more of a thing. And, you know, it's always a debate with public health people of at what point are we trying to out-policy something versus actually address a behavior. So what are some of your takes on that?
Well, with all policy, you have to, you look at the ideal situation. In a perfect world, what would I like to happen? If in a perfect world, I'd like tobacco to go away. I'd like to not have a 21 policy because nobody gets tobacco, okay?
Yeah.
You know?
I wanted to tell Emily and our listeners about what you used to do as Surgeon General when you saw. Yeah, I want everyone to hear that.
I'll tell them the story. Yeah. I'll finish answering this and I'll tell the story. But I think that in a perfect world, you'd say, well, why do we allow this product to be promulgated when almost 500,000 people die from it every year, millions more suffer irreparable harm from cancer, heart disease, strokes, you know, all the way down, oral disease. And yet, if this many people were dying from plane crashes, all the planes would be grounded.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so, then you see the special interest groups, the lobbies, and how it happens. And we've made some progress because, as you can see now, is that we don't have advertising anymore. When I was a kid, The hero of the movie always smoked a cigarette at the end, and his pretty girlfriend had a cigarette, you know, and they went off into the sunset together. So there was this idea that it was good. Doctors used to advertise tobacco on TV. All the movie stars used to. Governor Reagan and President Reagan had his cigarette. And it was at a time when we didn't have good information. Okay, so it became socially acceptable. Now what I love, Santa, what you said, is that it's socially unacceptable. You light up in a restaurant, the whole restaurant's going to start looking at you like, dude, get outside.
Yes,
we don't smoke here.
Yeah.
And I think that was one of my goals and my colleagues. Let's make this socially unacceptable.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay? Because the people then will drive it. But what's happened is the industry has left the United States and does their billboards and marketing elsewhere. So that if you look at their revenue, they're still making a ton of money.
Yeah.
They just make it in a different way. And now they're buying the e-cigarette companies, which makes it even more difficult because people go, well, if the tobacco company owns that, I don't want to bother with that. Yet there are reasonable ones out there that are trying to do harm reduction. So how do you separate those two? So like a 21 policy, fine. I mean, certainly 18. A lot of these things you have infinite needs and finite resources in policy. Is that a battle that you want to fight when kids are still not getting vaccinated, when we have 15 or 20% of people can't get mental health care? You know, and I go down the list, I would say, it's important, but these kids ain't eating.
Yeah.
These kids have no place to live. Mm-hmm. There's dirty water, sanitation. So I'm thinking, yeah, I agree it's important, but if I'm going to triage my list and I have only these resources, that's probably not one I'm going to go after.
Definitely.
I'm going to go after something else.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Okay. And as public health professionals, we have to be triage officers every day.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're going to have a list of 50 things that need to be done. And the mistake that some of my colleagues make is, okay, I'm going to wrap my arms around this community and we're going to save them.
Yeah.
How? You may get to one or two things. It's incremental. As much as we have big hearts and we want to make it better for everybody, the fact of the matter is we're restrained by politics, we're restrained by special interests, we're restrained by the resources we have to do it. So you have to pick and choose.
Yeah.
So that wouldn't be one of my top priorities, but I think it's very important. And if it was up to me, I'd get rid of tobacco. But that'll never happen. Okay, I can make that a policy and say, okay, I'm going to get rid of it. But I'll be Don Quixote chasing the windmill. I'm going to go on forever, okay?
Yeah.
Because of special interest groups.
Yeah.
But there will be a day when your children make it so politically incorrect that smoking could be a reportable event.
Yeah.
That's what I hope will happen.
I hope so.
Yeah. We'll see. Yeah. Got a lot of work to do.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think you owe us a story, too.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe you haven't heard it. So one of the things I tell the kids, you know, one of the things I think that's important in public health that often our colleagues don't remember is there's nothing more powerful than telling a story with the science.
Mm-hmm.
Give somebody an example. So one I use is, as Surgeon General, I often would travel in Independence Avenue and Constitution, where all of the various operating directors, so labor, agriculture, all of the departments are there. And you have meetings, and then you're up on the Hill at the Capitol, or you're going to the White House. And back when I was Surgeon General, they were outlawing smoking within buildings. So people would have to smoke outside the entryway, you know, and they'd smoke. So I would, with my staff, I'd be going into a building, and rather than using like the secret VIP entrance, I would say, let's go through the front entrance. And they'd laugh and go, oh, here he goes again, you know. And I'd be in uniform, you know, as a Surgeon General, you're an admiral. So I have even my service dress blues and my white uniform on and my khaki uniform. And I'd go and I'd see somebody in the building. Say, hey, how are you, Emily? How you doing? See, you're smoking. What are you smoking? They look at you and I say, hey, I'm Rich Carmona. I'm the Surgeon General. And usually you'd get, yeah, no shit. Really? Surgeon General? You know? And I say, yeah. And they say, what are you smoking? And I take the pack. I go, oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Come here. Emily, see back here on the bottom, it says Surgeon General. I stay up all night and sign these things and you keep smoking. I said, so, and the reason I do it is to get a conversation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they kind of look at me, you don't really sign those things. Well, I said, you know, I have help. But I said, the reason my name is on there is this stuff kills. Mm-hmm. Why do you smoke? And there's where you see the essence of public health, mm-hmm. and the challenge of living in a democracy.
Yes.
And what that is that 2/3, 3/4 of the people would say, oh, doc, I've tried to quit. I can't. I mean, then they give you a story. I did this, and my mother still smokes, and my wife did, and I kept smoking. And then I said, so why'd you give up? Well, I don't have health insurance. I had all the reasons that you could expect. I'd say, okay, take out of my pocket. We started a 1-800-QUIT line when I was Surgeon General. Mm-hmm. And I said, call this number. Even if you don't have insurance, they will help you. And they'll give you several modalities to try and quit smoking. Because if you don't, you're going to shorten your lifespan probably by a decade or so. Last few years of your life are going to be miserable with either cancer, pulmonary disease, oral ulcers, you know, this kind of thing. So, you know, you might want to do this.
Yeah, and as public health professionals, it's all about starting that conversation in a way that somebody will want to engage with you.
So that it resonates. But here's the other side. A minority of people, I would say 1/3 to 1/4, as they're smoking, would say, well, doc, you know, Surgeon General, that's pretty interesting, but I'm an American and you can't tell me what to do. But I want to make the point here that often these issues that are most contentious are the individual right versus the collective right of society. Absolutely. And that's what I talk to the class about. So how do you draw the line? Okay. And if you're a non-smoker and that person's smoking and you're breathing it or your pregnant wife is breathing it and could affect the baby, now what do we do? Does the government have a role in regulating that? Okay. So we've done it in bits and pieces, smoke-free areas, you can't do this, but we're not there yet. And it's still deleterious to your health, especially secondhand smoke that used to be dismissed as no big deal. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll sit in the back of the plane. I have a smoke-free area over here. Our report convincingly showed all of that stuff is bogus because there's no filtration systems to do that. Right. So the point being that when you think about all of these issues, it often comes down to individual right versus collective rights. And what I really call that is about, and I just gave a presentation on this to a large organization, about the challenge of public health in a democracy. Okay, yeah. I know what's best for the society. I can't rule on that. I give you the information. But if people choose not to wear a helmet, not to wear a seatbelt, engage in high-risk activities, they are allowed to do that. Unfortunately, the burden of the disease they incur, we pay for.
Yeah.
Okay. At a time when the national debt is higher than it's ever been at $22 trillion, we're spending 19% of our GDP on what we call healthcare. It's sick care. 80 cents of every dollar is spent on chronic diseases that we cause. Until we can get a handle on the public's behavior and somehow inspire them to do healthier things, this is going to continue to grow. And we're almost $1 in $5 being spent now.
Yeah.
So that's, you think about almost anything that's contentious. It comes down to, I'm an American. I can do what I want. I mean, I can own a gun. You can't tell me not to own a gun.
Right.
I don't have to wear a seatbelt. I mean, sure, you'll get a ticket for wearing a seat, not wearing it, but you can still not do it and you pay the ticket, okay? Or motorcyclists without helmets, okay? The list is endless.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, with public health consequences.
And I think the point you bring up on literacy is really interesting. So this is something I've been thinking a lot about where it's like, we, as experts, know when something is good quality evidence, but the masses don't always. And sometimes, like, people who are really well educated will go with stuff where it's like, that wasn't a good source. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is in today's day and age, it's like anyone can find something to support
that
individual right that they really want to cling to, even if it really is harming the collective peace. Yeah. So do you have
I think that if we want to center it in more of an issue, I think the debate where that really comes into play is the vaccination debate.
Well, I just did a presentation on that, too. But I think that there's two things. And, you know, Congress is no different, I'll be quite honest with you. They, and because they're often looking, cherry-picking the information they need to support their preconceived political motivated. And both sides do it, left and right, okay? But for the Surgeon General, you're looking at real science. Mm-hmm. What's valid here? What's been studied? And if we know it, we know it. If we don't know it, then what do we need to do to find out the information? But the political parties, you know, are more tribal now, so it makes it much more difficult. And so there's the vaccine one you just brought up is an important one, where when I was Surgeon General, this is when it first hit. And we had a very well-known movie person whose child had autism, and she went public and said, this government condoned this because this government is supporting the pharmaceutical industry to, you know, it was all of these myths about that we were trying to help the pharma industry to make money and we were balancing that on the back of vaccinations. I went on live TV and went in front of the media, got vaccinated for smallpox on TV. And I told the public, Mike, all my children I love, they're all vaccinated, okay? Okay. And I said, and I told them the truth. I said, most of the pharmaceutical companies, and at the time there was only one and a half pharmaceutical companies that were still doing vaccines, because most of the companies dropped out because they were losing money.
Yeah.
Because we would ask them to make 5 or 10 million doses, and then we'd only use 50, 60%, and they'd incur the loss. Mm. So at that point, the government was considering going into the vaccine business, and most of us, including our head of our vaccines, said, that's not a good idea. You don't want the government doing vaccines. What we should do is keep the innovation in the private sector and let them continue to develop the vaccines. But let's, when we ask them for 2 million doses, we'll pay for 2 million. And then if we don't get them used, we incur the loss, not them. And that's how the system has changed now. And so we had that was a good solution. But the challenge we have now is because of that particular incident, which I think was that critical juncture, and then other well-known people with limited information or bias going public and saying, well, I'm not going to have my children vaccinated because. And you fill in all the things they list. None of them have any scientific validity.
Right.
Okay. And then you have a governor, I think he's from, might be Missouri, I can't remember the exact state, who has like 6 or 7 kids and said, well, my kids aren't being vaccinated. And when he didn't get them vaccinated, but when he found a family that had measles, he allegedly took them all over there to get them exposed. And I said, that's criminal.
Yeah.
That's criminal.
Absolutely.
You know? I mean, because as you know, it's usually not lethal, but it can make you pretty sick and scar and everything else. So I'm thinking, you know, would we not give people polio vaccines now? I mean, it just does. When I was a kid, every mom was afraid to send their kid to school because they're all the kids, all the pictures of kids in iron lungs.
Oh, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And so we don't have that anymore. You know, and I had, in my presentation recently, I said, vaccines are arguably the, in fact, I think it's going to be an op-ed. It should be coming out soon. Vaccines are the most important scientific discovery in the history of the world.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
When you think of all the disease, 14, 15 communicable diseases that are, boom, you know, if you take the vaccine. So there's another example of the rights of the individual. And then you get into the issue of herd immunity and things like that. So, okay, your 9 kids aren't getting vaccinated and you're not. So what happens? Oh, we have a measles epidemic. Mm-hmm. We have whooping cough. We had a kid who got tetanus.
Yeah.
Tetanus in this country this year.
Those pictures are horrifying.
Yeah. So I'm saying all of that's preventable. So your right to not immunize your child, okay, I understand, but what about the thousands of others who are getting the disease that don't want it now because your child is a vector and the disease gets spread? Who's going to pay for all of this now because you're exercising your individual right? And again, we go back, what is the government's role then to intervene and say, no, I'm sorry? And the problem is we have 50 states with 50 different approaches.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't come to school unless you're vaccinated, okay? And then we have the religious exclusions, philosophical exclusions, allergy exclusions. So in the editorial I wrote, I said, I believe if there are legitimate exclusions to me would be, and not that I'm saying religion is not important, but you'd have to look at those to see they're legitimate. But on a scientific basis, if you're allergic to the vaccine components, no, you can't. That'd be unethical, okay? But if you're going to do that, then I would say anybody who opts out, needs to be monitored, and we can monitor you so that if you get sick, I want to know where you are. Okay. And so I can have a database with tracking you. And yes, you'll give up a little of your privacy, but in order for us to protect society, I need to know if you get sick, because I may want to isolate or quarantine you right away so that 100 other kids don't get sick. So these are contentious issues that we have to deal with now as a society. And in my job as Surgeon General, the bigger I want to support you expressing your rights, but my bigger commitment is to society at large. And hopefully I don't have to recommend restricting your rights, but if I have to, I will consider it for the greater good of society. That's the issue.
And we also have to take into consideration who is impacted by this. So if you're immunocompromised or if you're elderly, if
there are those exceptions. And so those are carve-outs.
Yeah, those are no, but we have to make sure that there is a herd immunity to protect those different populations.
Oh, yeah. That's another good point. Yeah.
Just looking out for, you know, the weakest in society that may need that help.
You know, there are people that you don't want.
They have a right to
be around and feel safe in every environment.
But you think about how difficult these discussions are, and you have people that come with, you know, legitimate religious concerns. You know, my God feels this way. That's a tough one, okay? But, you know, I think then, and in fact, when in the op-ed I wrote, I talked about that. You know, we have to sit down and have a discussion. Is there a way we can continue to protect society and still be able to recognize the legitimate rights, concerns of the individual?
We should wrap up. Is there any
other?
No, I don't. I mean, I have so many more lingering questions, I'll do it another time.
Come back at another time, because first of all, I want to commend you on what you guys are doing. You're young public health professionals. You have a lot of things on your plate. You have a lot of things you can be doing other than trying to develop a distribution network for important scientifically vetted content on policy and public health issues. So I think, you know, we owe you.
We're just trying to get famous. We're just trying to get as famous as you.
This is my
it was either this or a reality TV show, and this was more our skills.
Well, but this is reality public health.
It's reality public health.
But I think that I want the university to know, and Mezkoff to know, that I think you're doing a tremendous public service. And I hope the word, you know, that there's a lot of people in your age group who will listen and maybe change their lives and have them think about things differently. Yeah. Because without improving the health literacy of the public on these complex issues and considering cultural competence, we're going to be fighting battles every day.
Well, thank you, Dr. Carmona, for coming in. I do think that you're such an inspirational public health professional. Thank you for speaking to my class. I do want to mention that the one day that you come in and speak is the one day that I don't have to tell anybody to put their phone away. So I want to thank you for that, too. But otherwise, people are texting straight.
That's a high bar. Put your phone away.
Yeah, you're doing a great public service for that. And just in general, we really appreciate having you as faculty at the college. And I really appreciate getting to talk to you and learn from you today. So thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate it. And I'm happy to be on your team, changing public health of our community and our nation.
If you are looking to obtain continuing education credits for listening to this podcast, please head to moodle.publichealth.arizona.edu and click on the Keeping Up with Public Health tab in the WR PHTC section and take the post-evaluation survey for this episode. This podcast is supported by the Western Region Public Health Training Center. You can find more of our work at www.wrphtc.arizona.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at WRPHTC. A special thank you to Eric Healy for editing and producing the show, in addition to creating the music for each episode.